The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Across a rich and varied career, Gabriel Byrne has made more than 70 films and shared the screen with the likes of Richard Burton and Vanessa Redgrave. He's won a Golden Globe for his role in HBO's In Treatment, been nominated for 3 Tony Awards, and has played unforgettable characters in such movies as Miller's Crossing, The Usual Suspects, and Into the West. A Washington Post review of his new memoir, Walking with Ghosts, notes that he has the mark of a real writer, a born storyteller with a poet's ear, saying his work dazzles with unflinching honesty as it celebrates the exuberance of being alive to the world despite living through pain. His portrait of an artist as a young boy is steeped in nostalgia of the best sort, recreating the pull of home. This evening, he will be joined in conversation with musician and novelist Wesley Stace. And now the screen is all yours.
Gabriel Byrne, welcome to Virtual Philadelphia.
Thank you, Wesley. It's such a pity that I couldn't actually be there. I've stopped in Philadelphia a few times. I worked there for about 2 weeks and didn't get to know the city terribly well. But it was a place that I always wanted to go back to. One of the first books that I ever read was, maybe somebody will know this book, it was called Off to Philadelphia in the Morning, and it was the story of Joseph Parry, the Welsh composer who went to live in Philadelphia, went from the Welsh valleys. And then in Brian Friel's play, which is Philadelphia, Here I Come. So the name of the city had a great resonance for me growing up, because Philadelphia, Off to Philadelphia in the Morning, was one of the first novels that I read. I was about 14 or 15 at the time. And I thought, wow, I'd love to go to Philadelphia. What a place that must be.
Well, the choice, you know, the opportunity always remains open to you.
I will definitely.
It's a city of brotherly love.
Yeah, of course, yes.
Now we're going to talk for, you know, half an hour or so, right, and then we're going to open it up to questions and answers,
yes,
which I suppose I'll be monitoring. Now, I think I'll let other people ask you about your movies, because I really, really loved your book. Without, you know, blowing too much smoke, it seems to me just one of the best examples of the genre I've ever read. And though it's so, so very different in tone to something like Moon's a Balloon or one of those David Niven type showbiz memoirs with pictures in it, which your book does not have, and you know, and those many anecdotes, which your book again does not have, I felt very, very safe in your hands as a narrator, in the same way I felt very comfortable, you know, in those books. And I must say it's probably my favorite book of the type. So I'm really happy to talk to you about it. And I really want to focus really on the writing of it. And so my question is a very simple one to start with. Why did you want to write this book when you chose to write the book? Had you kept journals before? Were you using stuff you'd written before? Had you written stories before, or fiction or anything? How did the book come about?
Well, it had a strange genesis. I didn't start out to say, okay, well, I'm going to write this memoir about, you know, about where I came from and, you know, where I went to. It started as some notes about a film that I was doing based on an album of songs by Leonard Cohen called Death of a Ladies Man. And I played a character, Leonard Cohen-ish type character, who's revisiting his life. And as I scribbled these notes, I began to realize that we tend to remember things in images. And the images have always been very much a part of my memory. So I started to think about these images and what it was that they conjured up and why they had remained with me for so long. And of course, when you look at the image, it reveals something deeper underneath, because the image is connected with emotion. And I decided that I would look at my life in the way that I think many, many people do. What were the seminal events that altered the way I saw the world? Some of the most monumental things that happen to us in life begin with an insignificant, inconsequential moment. A door that you open that, you know, you meet somebody at a party, or you take a trip, that things that you don't really think are going to change your life. Well, what are the deep and profound things that we all share in common? An awareness of time. When was the first time I became aware of time? When was the first time I became aware of tragedy? I was 9 years of age and a friend of mine drowned, and it was the first time I had ever cried for somebody else, which means that I was beginning to experience empathy. When I went to the fairground with my father for a bicentennial celebration for the Guinness factory where he worked, my brother said to him on the way home, "That was the best day of my life. I can't wait for the next one." And my father said, There won't be a next one. That was a bicentennial. It could be 200 years and we'll all be gone. And even though at 9 years of age, I couldn't articulate what time was, I understood in some vague way that time was tremendously important. And when my friend died, I understood in a vague way again about death. I just understood that he was not coming back. So I decided to look at those moments, the moments that change us, either consciously or unconsciously. And by connecting images to those moments, I excavated some kind of a structure that worked for me. And I, as much as I possibly could, I thought about the sounds, the smells, the sights, the way people spoke at that time. And I said, okay, if I can try to recreate that truthfully, and I can isolate these moments of importance in my life, there might be something in here. But even at that stage, I didn't think, oh, this is a memoir. And it's a surprise to me that that's what it turned out to be, because it might have turned out to be a novel. It might have been. But I just found that I have a tremendous regard for novelists, and I haven't read a great deal of memoir. And as you know, Wesley, the structure of a novel seems to me to be freer, in the sense that you have more latitude to move characters around and invent and so forth. But a memoir is essentially, if it's truthful, it's essentially about trying to capture something that's true. And I decided there'd be no point in writing a memoir if I wasn't going to be as truthful as possible. So those things all came gradually into the writing of it.
Can I just ask the very simple question? Have you done writing before? I mean, are you a journal keeper?
No, I found that people say to me all the time, "You have an incredible memory." And I never really thought very much about that, because I thought everybody had an incredible memory. But I think when you're a child, you are open to experience in a way that you're not later on in life. We get so used to things that we tend to remember only the significant things in life that are happening. It's one of the things people talk about during COVID. You know, they say all the days are just, they're just melting one into the other. I think sometimes I think the reason for that is because nothing of import is actually happening day to day when you're living such a prescribed, it's just prescribed routine. I've lost my train of thought now. What was I saying? Go ahead.
Well, so I was asking really about, you know, if you kept journals and stuff like
that. Oh, yes.
Does that push you to remember what you were going to say, or shall I ask away?
No, I yes, it does. No, I've never kept journals. But I do have this, strong memory for the events of my life. And I do tend to think about them. So they're always kind of fresh in my mind, you know. And if something slightly out of the ordinary happens, it goes into some repository. And, you know, James Joyce said once, somebody asked him how he wrote. And he said, well, I lower the bucket into the well of the unconscious, and whatever comes up, that's what I start writing about. What kind of amazed me was the amount of stuff that's in the unconscious that we don't actually often get in touch with until we start to write it down, whether it's in a journal or in what you think, God, where did that come from? How did I remember that piece of information? I have a good memory, no journals. Music, funnily enough, brings back a great deal to me.
Well, actually, since you just mentioned music, and I like to free associate as well as ask any questions.
Yes, sure.
There isn't really, in a sense, a lot of music in the book. And yet I got a feel in the book for somebody who is very close to music. Yet one of the only specific pieces you mention, I remember, is the pure emotion of John Lennon's Beautiful Boy. Mm-hmm. You kind of bring, you play yourself, I think, mm-hmm. in the book, you remember to bring yourself back to mm-hmm. kind of, or perhaps to calm you down in a moment of stage fright. Tell us about the particular emotion of that song or music in general, because it seems a very musical book to me.
Well, that's an interesting observation, Wesley, because I first of all wrote it in free verse because I wanted to know what the rhythms of it were. And then I went back and rewrote it again, but keeping in touch with the rhythms. One of the things I put in the book was that when that music teacher was trying to teach me the accordion said to me that the entire world of emotion is in seven notes.
Right.
That is something that never left me. Whether it's Irish Victorian music, or whether it's the Beatles, or whether it's Mario Lanza, it doesn't matter. It's the idea that in seven notes, the entire emotional, intellectual, and spiritual life of the universe can be fitted, and it's still developing. People are still using those seven notes to express the inexpressible. And I remember somebody asked, it was either Paul McCartney or Sting, I can't remember, but it was an interview where they talked about how do you get the inspiration to actually write a song. And he said, it's like you're a television aerial. It's out there in the ether and you pull it down out of this mysterious place and you put it down into a form that is melodic and also has an emotional significance to it. And How that happens, I don't know that anybody can actually explain. I think, as you would probably know, being in the world of music and the world of literature, it's probably very difficult to articulate where that thing comes from. Just like with acting, but there are certain things that can trip you into the correct emotion. And when I was in that Broadway dressing room, I knew that I had to reach a level of emotion that I just wasn't feeling. Sometimes you go on stage, and I'm sure you felt this, you walk on stage and you think, I just can't get it tonight. I don't know where it is, and it's not here, and how do I access it? And is the audience going to find that out, or can I float by just on technique? And so I listened to Beautiful Boy that particular night, and every night since. And there's something so pure about the song, and so unashamedly loving in it, mm-hmm. that it just went straight into a part of me that just fired up emotions that allowed me to walk on stage. And because what I wanted to be, which is what frustrates me about not being a musician, it's like when I used to go to the movies, I wanted the world of the movies to come out with me into the streets and right. for the movies to be real life. But once you went out past the popcorn thing, it was over. And you went out into the rainy streets of Dublin or wherever. When I hear a piece of music or when I hear a performer perform, I want what they create to be what my life is. Do you know, if Frank Sinatra sings a song, for example, I want what he's singing to be what I live, not just what I feel. If that makes sense.
It does. And isn't the enemy of all these things, whether it be, you know, writing a song or trying to trick yourself into the moment when you can go on stage and do that, isn't the enemy of all that artistic sincere emotion, self-consciousness? Isn't it when you become aware of yourself that you have to go, okay, now's when the technique comes in, because I am suddenly aware of myself. I mean, and I feel this when I'm writing, and indeed when I'm singing on a stage. Sometimes I'm lost in the song and everything's beautiful. Other times I'm going, I'm really thinking about the shopping list right now, which is something I think you specifically say in your book, felt it myself. But isn't kind of self-consciousness the enemy, the thing that stops you getting lost in the thing you are very good at doing?
Absolutely. On the one hand, performers are not machines. I think it's a fallacy to think that people go out and they become transported by what they're doing.
Yes.
I don't think that's true. And I think the glory of having good technique is that the technique can help you access the deeper part of the emotional part of what you're trying to do, but it doesn't always work, and you have to be okay with the fact that it doesn't always work. I think self-consciousness, for sure, the enemy of relaxation, which is, I think, you need to a great extent to perform. Is self-consciousness.
Yes.
And a version of did I leave the kettle on is not serving you well.
Yes, yeah, and of course, and what that self-consciousness is doing is actually what you want the John Lennon song to do for you.
Exactly
the opposite of what the self-consciousness
is. Right, that's exactly it.
Okay, so let's go back to the writing of your book. There's a fantastic anecdote in your book, which you need or need not tell because everybody's going to read the book anyway, about Brendan being on a bus. Mm-hmm. I've seen a wonderful TV show you did about George Bernard Shaw. Mm. And you've mentioned James Joyce already, and we mentioned backstage, as it were, Paul Muldoon. So how do you feel linked to that Irish literary heritage, and in what way do you find, I mean, to me, you seem to be an heir to all that stuff, to have it inside you and to be able to harness it.
Well, thank you.
That's funny tradition. You know, it's a tradition of humor and storytelling and modernism as well, which your book is a very well-structured book in that sense.
Well, I often wondered why it is that the Irish have a reputation, a literary reputation that's worldwide. I mean, of course, to a certain extent, it's a generalization, but I've often thought that the Irish imagination is linked to our history. I could be completely wrong about that. But you have a country who's, you know, for 300 or 400 years, we were denied books. We were denied learning. Literature went underground. It became an oral tradition. And poets could extemporize poetry without ever putting a pen to paper. And those poems were carried around among people and repeated over and over again so that they become part of the community consciousness. And because of that culture going underground, and because it was improvised, and it became, for want of a better word, a people's literature, it involved the imagination. Because when you're sitting around a fire and you're telling a story, that is pure theater. And you are transported by the storyteller into all kinds of worlds where you don't quite know whether they're real or whether they're imagined. And I was very fortunate to have seen the last of the traveling storytellers, guys who went from house to house and got a bed in return for telling a story. And they would sit there, and they were master actors and master storytellers, and would know how to end a sequence with silence so that everybody was agape listening for the next bit. They knew how to raise and lower the voice and so forth. And I thought that must have been what it was like to have been around those firesides 100 years ago, where the act of telling the story involved not just imagination, but a powerful form of being able to tell that story well. They also understood at a very basic level that you can't just tell deadly serious stories. You have to sprinkle them with a bit of humor. And so the humor also drew you in, as well as the well-turned phrase. And if anybody is interested in what an old Gaelic or Irish storyteller sounds like, on YouTube, there's a wonderful, brilliant Irish storyteller called Eamon Kelly, who passed away some time ago. But he was a direct link with that world of storytelling, and the stories he told were fantastical, funny, satirical, and subversive, all in the same story. And he had a charming way of presenting it. So there was tremendous respect in Ireland, I suppose, because the fact that books were not available, tremendous respect for learning, tremendous respect for literature. And for example, the word poet in Gaelic is Fila, which means a seer. The respect for the poet was somebody who could see into the future and see into the past. So it was almost like it was a magical occupation. And the idea of writing something down, the prestige that was attached to that was absolutely enormous. And so it's hard to believe that out of one small country, when the entire country was speaking Gaelic up to 150 years ago, more or less, produced through the collision of English and Irish Oscar Wilde, George Bernard Shaw, Sean O'Casey, James Joyce, William Butler Yeats, Samuel Beckett, Flannery O'Brien, Seamus Heaney. I mean, it's an astonishing roll call, not to mention Brendan Behan, and a lot of writers who never got their full, you know, their full recognition. Edna O'Brien, John McGarren, so many. But that is an incredible roll call of people who have written and expressed themselves through the spoken word for a country that didn't have access to the spoken word for so long, for the written word, I mean, for so long.
Yeah, and of course, and I'm not forgetting Lawrence Stern, who I always like to...
And Lawrence Stern.
...shove in there as an early...
right.
It's a beautiful answer to my question, that, because while acknowledging that literary tradition that the literary people know about, what I love about your answer there is that the storytelling tradition of Eamon Kelly, was he called?
Eamon Kelly, yes.
Yeah, Eamon Kelly. That is what your book does for me. It's a heavy book, Gabriel. It's a pretty heavy book. It's about issues. It's about issues you have. It's about dramatic parts of your life. You don't belabor, for example, your alcoholism, which other people might make a bigger feature of in the book. You manage to somehow, and I think brilliantly, get it into a pretty short chapter with one or two very key moments, and then you're able to say, I haven't drunk in 20 years. But there's a leavening of these very heavy moments, the death of your friend by drowning, the possible abuse, all these things, with humor that is on. And when you're telling me about that storyteller, that really to me seems the literary heritage that you might be harnessing even more than the written one, in a certain sense.
That's interesting. I never actually thought about that, but in respect of those amazing men that I just mentioned, those writers, I think what they all had in common, whether it was Beckett or Oscar Wilde, they all had humor in common. There's no way that you could read Waiting for Godot and say that's not a funny play.
Yeah.
Or that you could encounter George Bernard Shaw and not say this guy has an incredible sense of humor. I don't know what it is. Is it the Irish... is it the Irish capacity to laugh in the face of despair? I don't know. I did talk about a gravedigger in that, who told me that he had seen everything in his graveyard, including a guy who couldn't stop laughing at his wife's funeral. I don't know that he was laughing at the wife per se. But there was a guy quite recently, an Irish bloke, who, when he was being buried, put down in the coffin, as they lowered the coffin into the grave, a voice came from inside the coffin saying, "Let me out of here." And what he had done was he had with his mate put a tape recording in the coffin. So what he wanted to do, just as he was going down into the ground for the last time, was to give everybody who was there a good laugh.
A little grave humor.
A grave humor, yeah.
So it seems to me, just to kick off any kinds of discussion, there is some really beautiful bits in the book, I think, where you as writer, but also as obvious perhaps an actor, and that's what I want you to answer, where you give voice to a lot of other people, not only your mother and father, as you might expect, putting words into their mouth, but also, just as a random example, the elderly Russian man who's an extra on a movie you're on or something, and you give him a quite long, let's call it a monologue, in there that is obviously something you remembered, that moved you, that you wanted to recreate. And I found it a very democratic book in its apportioning of speeches to other people. Just tell us about that, because I thought that was a really great aspect of the book.
Well, thank you. And I think that was something I was pretty conscious about, because I'm a great, I love listening to other people's stories, because everybody has an extraordinary story. They may not tell it to you immediately, but if you're lucky, they will reveal it. In the case of that particular man, what I could never forget was that he went to war and he expected to die. This was in Russia in 1944. And he took a photograph of his wife with him in his wallet. And he lost all contact with time and place. And he was in the mountains and they were fighting Germans. And one day he realized, every night before he would go to sleep, he would look at the photograph of his wife so that he could keep connection with her. And then one night he realized he'd lost the photograph. So what he had to do was imagine his wife. And so the imagination became more powerful than the actual picture itself. So when he was freed from this place where time and time meant nothing, that they were told one day randomly the war was over, and he made his way back to the village that he had lived in. And he arrived there at 5 o'clock in the morning, just as dawn was coming up. And he saw the house that he had left however long ago. And he wondered even if his wife and children would be alive. So he came down and he walked up the garden path. And he stood outside the window because he couldn't bear to go in. And the wife came to the window and she looked out. And she thought that what she was seeing was a ghost. And he thought he was still dreaming. And he was very moved when he told me that, because that seemed to sum up to me a great deal about how we remember and how we pass from one place to another, how we pass from dream into reality and into what we like to think of as being ghostly. And so I remembered his story really, really well. And what he said that really moved me was that they just kept looking at each other. She kept looking through the window and he kept looking in, and they couldn't bear to move because she thought if she moved, the ghost of her husband would go. And he thought that if he moved, the dream of his wife would vanish. And that to me seemed to be an incredibly powerful moment, because I couldn't put my finger on it, but I felt like I'd lived that experience many times myself. And that's why I put it in the book. Because the book is actually, yes, it is about time and it's about the past and it's about memory, but it's also about dream and what our notion of what a ghost is. And the ghost can be the past, and it can be the people who've gone before you. It can be your regrets, it can be your sins, your guilt. One day we will become the ghosts walking behind our own children.
That is very interesting. And what it made me also think of was that in that moment there, what you also have a kind of parable of storytelling, that the story's in the middle and it might be one person's dream. And, you know, another person might be haunted by it, as it were. And that the story is a thing that's right in the middle and is, by the writer, a kind of contrived. It's a contrivance.
Yes.
In the sense that what he was telling you was a remembered, and it, not to diminish his amazing memory, but of course he, in a sense, made it into that memory.
Yes.
And that is very pertinent to my next question, because what there are bits in the book that are, I've just got to find my little note on this. Yeah. There's a way you draw threads together that I want to know how, whether it happened during the writing, whether it's something you went into the writing with, whether it's something you discovered during the writing or whether it's something you edited later. For example, there is an incredible little chapter where you seem to draw together an initial urge to be an actor and later alcoholism and the church, all in one crazy scene, really, where you're kind of, explain the scene and then address in some way, if you like, that whether that is something you came up with later to bind it all together, something you went in thinking that's where it's all from, or etc.
Yeah, that's another good question. As I was writing it, it came to me because I thought to myself, that's connected to this. Like, I never saw that bridge before, but yes, that's connected. Yeah. Like, I was a very shy child, extremely shy. I couldn't, like, very, very shy. And I talked about my mother pulling me out from under the bed by one leg to go down and play the accordion for my Uncle Harry. And that child who didn't want to be performing actually becomes an altar boy and walks out in front of a congregation of people to do something that is, I'll never forget the nerves of that. It was as bad as any Broadway play. Why did I do that? I have no idea what propelled me to do that. I drank the altar wine at the behest of this other kid who used to drink altar wine liberally every after every mass. And he said, "Oh, you should get some of this stuff into you. It's great. It's good for getting you out, but it's not great wine." How he knew at 10 it wasn't great wine, I don't know. But he knew it was junk wine from a place that in the city that the priests used to drink. Anyway, it did produce a fire inside me and I did feel great. And we drank it before the 10 o'clock mass. And unfortunately, I was drunk. I don't know about him, but I was drunk on the altar, which is a form of sacrilege. And I remember trying to lift the book from one side of the altar to the other, and I fell down the steps and ended up at the just before the congregation. A most shameful thing to happen. But when I was doing that, I thought to myself, oh, well, I'll just talk about being an altar boy. And what came out of it was acting. You're an altar boy, you're acting. And then I was drunk and I later became an alcoholic. So they were all in there at 8 and 9 years of age. The pattern of my life was kind of laid down. But I didn't realize that when I was really writing it. It was only afterwards I thought, you know, in our lives, if we look at them, so many things are connected that we don't actually realize when we recount our lives. Like if your son or your daughter or your wife or lover says to you, tell us about yourself, you will tell, you know, but do you see the connections? Do you say, well, I should have known at 8 years of age that that was going to happen to me? There's a part of me that didn't want to be an altar boy. There's a part of me didn't want to be an actor. And there's for sure a part of me that did not want to be an alcoholic. But why that happened to this day, I still don't know.
And it sits together. I mean, it's funny you say that. I have a friend who was an actor, and he stopped acting, as some people have to do, and he became a priest and an undertaker. And they are the most on show. You know, if you're not going to be an actor, who wouldn't be an undertaker or a priest? Because you're playing a part in front of a lot of people, and it's got to be very dignified, not drunk on the altar wine, you know.
Obviously. Well, Laurence Olivier's father was a minister in the Church of England. Bergman's father was a pastor in, in Sweden. And of course, a man standing up there with an entire captive audience. And some of them were brilliant at what they did. Some of them were dreadfully boring. And the audience knew it, the congregation knew it, and say, oh, Jesus, not this guy. And he'd be going on for hours about something. And then there were other guys who stood up and said, God, he was, that guy was, people come out like rating the performances of the priests. And those guys, don't tell me those guys wouldn't have been happy to have been, you know, playing Hamlet or King Lear or whatever. And so there is a connection between the church and the theatre, a very obvious one. The congregation, the audience, the ritual of the mass, the ritual of the play. And I think the religion, the Catholic religion that I was brought up in, apart from all the awful things that it inculcated, it played to your imagination as well in a fantastic way. And so I loved it from that point of view. I didn't like a great deal else about it, but I loved the ritual. I loved the music of it. I loved where it was like a very benign fairy tale. There was no bad end in it unless you went to hell, but you kind of ignored that part of it. But it was tremendously, for a young kid, it really sparked my imagination. That and the movies and the theater. And that theater that my mother took me to, where there was a back alleyway, and Judy Garland sang from her balcony to the theater goers beneath. The context of being that near to a Hollywood star, it was like some saint came down from heaven and was, you know, because the Blessed Virgin appeared in Lourdes in 1958 to three peasant children, and she appeared at Knock in Ireland, but for some reason it didn't have the same prestige. She appeared in Ireland, I mean, like, when she, no, Lourdes was where she really lived. But Judy Garland, Roy Rogers, Bob Hope, all these people came to Dublin, and it gave us this sense of, my God, there's this incredible place out there called Hollywood, and there's heaven that you can get to. So it was firing imagination to be somewhere else, magical.
And of course, you know, with the Catholic Church, it's always blows my mind how, you know, that it's sight and sound, but it's also smell in there. It's like incense, and it's dry ice, and it smells. Sure. It's an odorama. It's incredible religion.
Sure.
I'm just going to ask you one very quick question, purely with the with my being able to give notice to the audience that I'm going to take some of the Q&A after this. So let me just ask one very quick question, and then I hope that, you know, perhaps they'll ask you about the movies and stuff.
Yes.
But I've been very happy to talk to you about the book. You mentioned you were blushing and shy and incredibly fearful, self-conscious, yet, I mean, in the sense, the whole book seems to me in a funny way to be asking the question, what went wrong to that small child to end up with, you know, you being in the movies and you being Judy Garland on that, you know, which, you know, you are. So how do you look back at that and see that little shy child and think of where you are now? And I mean, it's like the joke about George Best in the hotel room with the prostitute.
Yes.
You know, what went wrong, George? And that's, I'm just asking you that joke, really.
Yeah. I can't answer. I honestly don't know how it happened, why it happened. I wish I could say it, because then I could say to somebody, oh, okay, here's the formula.
Right.
But there's a line in Yeats which is not entirely applicable at all to my situation, where he talks, it's a poem called A Young Airman Foresees His Death. And he talks about in the he's addressing the young pilot who dies, and he talks about I can't remember the exact line now, but what earthly instinct drove to this tumult in the sky? What was it that made you want to do this? Yeats doesn't answer it. But at the beginning of the poem, he says, I belong here. I don't belong in other places. Kiltartan is my country. Kiltartan people are my people. Why am I here? Why am I in this airplane? Why? I think if we all look at ourselves and we say, how did I end up here? Why am I married to this woman? Why am I living in this house? Why am I doing this job? Why am I regretful? Why am I hopeful? Why do those things that that dictate the life that we live, how did they happen? And that's really why I started to keep going, to try to find out how it happened. And here's the end of it, Wesley, is that I don't know how it happened. I don't know why it happened. I can't reconcile the child being pulled out under the bed, badly playing the accordion. I can't reconcile who I am as a, for want of a better word, somebody who's well known, though I don't think of myself in that way at all. Life for me is still a battle against my insecurities and my fears and my doubts, but less so, ironically, as life goes on, less so. It doesn't matter so much anymore. If you forget your lines, or you go out on stage and you're singing a song and you can't quite hit it, and you just get, it doesn't matter that much. And whereas before, it always seemed to be life and death.
The end. And is it, in fact, as one gets a bit older, that one can finally admit that in the end, there isn't some big kind of teleological end in sight? It's just all chance. All so many of those things that, of course, it's upbringing and it's education, a million things, but we can't control any of the things really in the end.
I think that's a really profound observation and lesson, because my theory is that we live in a world of chaos, and that what we impose on that chaos is order, whether it's laws, whether it's religion, whether it's morality. And what we don't understand is that the world is not an ordered place. It's essentially chaotic. So that when something happens that is chaotic, we say, how the hell did that happen? Where did it? The reality is that chaos is the norm, not normal. Yes. So is it destiny? Is it preordained? No, I believe that we're all accidents and nothing is preordained. And there is no guarantee of resolution or fairness or justice or reward for a just life. There isn't. But that's okay, because that's what life is. And I think sometimes we get very discontented because expectation can be the enemy. Desire can be the enemy.
Yes, yeah,
I deserve this. This should happen. Why the hell isn't it happening?
That's why Buddhism is such a good alternative.
Or Stoicism.
Got to get rid of the attainment. Okay, we've got to take some questions before we die. How does Miss... Oh, there's two feelings about... There's two feelings. There's two questions about entreatment, so I'll ask them both together.
Yes.
Karen Scher asks, how does Mr. Byrne feel being a writer is similar to and different from being like the therapist he played? And Terry Jason asks, please tell us about filming in treatment. It must have been emotionally draining for you. Were you offered the opportunity to do you again? We will miss you in that role. So a couple of questions about in treatment.
Yeah, I think in treatment was a revolutionary program for television. So many TV programs and films concentrate on action and sensation, and very little in terms of, I'm not talking about everything, but a lot of what happens in those in film and television. It's not about the complexity of human behavior. This was essentially about people talking about their innermost feelings to a man who was himself imperfect, who was, as it happened, a brilliant therapist. As they did this, a picture was building up of a society that rarely is examined in conventional fiction. For example, there was a story of a pilot who had dropped a bomb on a village in Iraq and was suffering guilt. Well, that's a huge question. How do we feel as a society about the dropping of bombs on innocent people? That's what the question, that's what the story was really asking. A woman who was 40 who wanted a baby but wasn't, had no man in her life. What does it mean to be 40 as a woman, not be married, not be in a relationship, but still want a child? So I was very proud of those aspects of life that were lit up by these stories. It was the most difficult job I've ever had to do. 35 pages of dialogue every 2 days. At the end of season two, I got extremely sick. I did 3 years of it and I couldn't do one extra day in it. I was wiped out, exhausted from it. And I was relieved to leave it behind. It did give me a tremendous respect for therapists and people who do that job and take on the pain and the suffering of people who are being ruthlessly honest or trying to be with them. In terms of, you know, writing versus in treatment, I think writing and acting are two very, very different disciplines. I think that they just come from different parts of the artists, you know, wherever that place is that stuff comes out of. It's just very different. It's very difficult to take a writer and say, okay, I want you to do Hamlet.
Yeah.
Very difficult. Or even singers to say, okay, can you do Lear? Forget the next album, do Lear instead. And very few, you know, actors make it into being writing. And that's why I was extremely nervous about doing it, because what I didn't want was people to say, oh, geez, here comes your man doing that, you know, a thing about, you know, I did this movie and I worked with that person and so forth. And that's my job. It's like saying to, in a way, saying to a plumber, tell us about all the great plumbers you've worked with and tell us about all the best sinks you put in. Well, what I wanted to do was to try to put down the plumber's inner life, if you know what I mean.
When I put out my first novel, I went to the great trouble of getting rid of my stage name and using my real name, because it
that's right. Yeah, of course.
7 years. I didn't want anybody to think it was something I'd just tell us, given all the kind of, you know, acting is a technique, and you know, you've been studying, you know, you've been at it for many years. What's a piece of work that when you think of it, rather than thinking, oh, I was ill during that, or that was difficult, or that I did that for the money, or whatever it is, I'm not imputing anything to your thought process. What is something that you look back at and feel really happy about? Like, that was a really great thing to be involved in and I acquitted myself nicely. And it could be something nobody's ever heard of, or it could be usual suspects.
That's the thing about movies, is that I think I did a lot of films that never really saw the light of day, for many reasons. I've always tried to choose carefully. But if I had to look back and say that I was proud of something, I would look back to Miller's Crossing and say that Miller's Crossing was a very powerful depiction of, it was a great gangster film, but it was a very literate gangster film based on, you know, Chandler-esque kind of characters. I think it's a really good film. Usual Suspects is something that became very well known. But I think I've done better performances in other things. I would have to say that if I look at stuff, it's probably stuff that nobody's seen, but that the theatre is the one that I think I am most proud of. My work in O'Neill's plays, Move with Mr. Gotten, or Long Day's Journey Into Night, or Touch of the Poet, because they are really tough plays to do. And they require every inch of and every ounce of everything that you have to give. And I think that being in a place where you're on stage and there's complete silence, and not the silence of people saying, when is this thing going to be over, but the silence of absolute rapt attention, and that you realize that what you're doing is you're channeling O'Neill's words for these people, and that you're part of the process. I would say the theatre Miller's Crossing, In Treatment, and about five or six other movies, and that's as good as it gets for most actors. Because if you look at any of the actors and you look at their careers, you'll say there's about 4, 5, 8, 10 films there that are great, and there's a lot that are not great. And it happens to directors too, and it happens to writers. It's very hard to keep, you know, reinventing being, well, you know, it just is.
Miller's Crossing, nobody's interested in this but me and possibly you, but I have a song on my third album called The Original Miss Jesus that's taken from a line in Miller's Crossing. Let's make this the last question, because I've taken up enough of your time, but it's a lovely question. Are there, Terry Alter asks, what are some plays you'd like to work in now in the near future? And I would like to spread that out a little more generally to say, is there anything in the world of acting that you would fancy doing that you have not yet done? I mean, in other words, are there ambitions left for you of a artistic nature as opposed to a professional nature?
Well, that's another interesting question, because when, you know, you get to a certain age, I mean, there's no point in me regretting that, you know, I can't do Hamlet. Though Richard Harris did play Hamlet when he was 50. And even he said, Jesus, how did anybody pay in to see that? But there's, for an older actor, there's Lear. There's not really that much. I never had any ambition to play any particular role. There were a couple of ones when I was younger that I was sorry I didn't get a chance to play. Like I'd love to have done Wuthering Heights. I think I could have brought something to Heathcliff. But nothing in the way of ambition. I know this sounds a little bit out of character, but I'm going to do a comedy. And when I began my career in Dublin, I essentially played comedy roles. I did a lot of comedy. And so when I started doing serious roles, people couldn't believe it. Now people can't believe that I did comedy, because they just won't give me the chance to do that. But it's a play, so I'm going to do it. But I have to say that I'm a bit more excited now about the idea of being in charge of the page and sitting down and saying, well, you know, let's see if this works. Understanding that writing is really hard. It's a difficult, difficult thing to do in a way that acting isn't. But at the same time, there's tremendous freedom in it. There's tremendous scope and latitude for expression. And so I'm, you know, working on a novel at the moment.
Oh, I was going to say that I did see a novel in your future.
Yeah, well, thank you. Yeah. And it's about the notion of home, and it's about the immigrant experience. And on a broader level, I think it's one of the themes that hasn't really been examined. How to exist when you're from one place in another place. What does that do to you as a person? What's that experience like? Because I think that so many countries, so many cultures know what that is. And as a young Catholic boy, we were always taught that we were exiles in this world and that our true home was heaven. So one more thing that the church realized is our universal longing for real home.
Well, I'm sure that I will be thrilled to read your novel. I found Walking with Ghosts to be an exceptionally great read. Everybody who gets this book because of this is going to be really satisfied with this. I just think it works on every level that you intended it to work on. And though we can't see these people who are watching us right now, I'm sure I embody them. And I would therefore like to say thank you very much for giving generously of your time tonight and for answering all my questions so helpfully.
Well, Wesley, you're really a wonderful interviewer. And talking at random, I've done chat shows with major chat show guys, and before they go on, they're handed a couple of sheets of, you know, questions, which they ask you one question, and while you're answering, they're looking down to see what the next question is. Or you say something like, you say something and they'll turn it into a joke. You become the straight man to their humor. They're not listening.
Yeah.
And they're not prepared. You'd be amazed at the amount of people that don't listen and are not prepared. And it's been, for me, first of all, thank you for inviting me on. And secondly, for paying such respect to the book and to the writing, because it's to the writing that really, really makes me feel honored that, you know, that it reached you in that way.
It certainly did. And I've been on the end of those awful interviewers as well. Yes. And I only have one technique for an interview, which is read the book or do whatever the research necessary, and then ask the first question and have a conversation. That's the way to do an interview.
Yes.
And also, I have another invitation for you that I want to ask you about later, but not on camera. So anyway, I want to say thank you to you, Gabriel Byrne, and thanks to the Free Library of Philadelphia for hosting us this evening. And I think they're going to pop on and close us off or whatever they do.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.